They are shredding ballots, in my opinion, based on what I've heard. And they are removing machinery, and they're moving it as fast as they can. Both of which are criminal fines, and you can't let it happen. And you are letting it happen. You know, I mean, I'm notifying you that you're letting it happen. So, look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state.
That was President Donald Trump Saturday on a leaked hour-long phone call with Georgia's Republican Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I'm Matt Welch, along with the Reason brain trust of Nick Gillespie, Peter Sudeman, and Catherine Mankiw Ward. Hi, team.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy New Year.
We are going to get to the contents of Trump's infamous phone call and Team Trump's Hail Mary efforts to make Wednesday's certification of Joe Biden's election somehow not happen or delayed. We'll do that in a moment. But first, Bound by Oath is a documentary podcast by our friends at the Institute for Justice. Its new season explores why it's so hard to sue government officials when they violate the Constitution. Even when people are clearly injured, it can be nearly impossible to obtain justice because of a mountain of immunities that the courts have placed in the way. Bound by Oath explores these issues through stories of real people fighting to vindicate their rights, as well as through interviews with the nation's foremost scholars and lawyers. Bound by Oath is available on any podcast app. Do it. You'll be glad you did. Okay, so the two last big events of the Trump presidency are going to be taking place this week. They are as follows. Number one is the aforementioned count by a joint session of Congress of each state's electoral college votes, a process which is usually pro forma, but this year has taken a Trumpy turn as two dozen House Republicans and about a dozen more in the Senate have announced that they plan to challenge the results in contested swing states. Vice President Mike Pence, who oversees the process, that is, if he survives the firing squad, just go look it up, has said that he supports the effort by Ted Cruz, Josh Hawley, and other senators to do some kind of emergency delay audit maneuver. The second last big event of the Trump presidency shouldn't actually really be categorized or wouldn't have been categorized as an event of the Trump presidency, but he sort of made it that way, which is the Georgia runoff election of two Senate seats. To see who is going to control the Senate after Joe Biden is sworn in as president. It has been much more about Trump and the recount and the election than it has been about partisan control. So, Catherine, let's start kind of melding those two. Are the pro-conspiracy Republicans or the anti-telling Trump to knock it off Republicans, are they making it more difficult to root for the usually better than nothing outcome of divided government?
Yeah, they are. I like it that it was actually difficult for you just then to even articulate what the camps are anymore, because it was like they're the anti-pro Trump conspiracy, but no, they're in favor of the conspiracy. No, they're against the Trump theory that there's a anyway. Yeah, they are making
it. We used to have just three, right? It was pro-Trump, anti-Trump, and anti-anti-Trump.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess there was a never Trump. There's a never Trump subset. No, I think, you know, the National Review article, the risky wager of betting on Trump, which begins, were the anti-Trumpers right all along? Like, what a powerful use of the rhetorical question lead, if ever there was one. And specifically, this is in reference to Trump's willingness to try every gambit, to pull every lever, to test every norm in service of doing the stuff Donald Trump wants done. And yeah, I reluctantly joined Team Divided Government only to find it to be the hardest time to be Team Divided Government in American history, because rooting for the GOP right now in particular, especially in Georgia, sure seems tough when we are getting stuff like these revelations from the Georgia phone call that Trump will stop at nothing and maybe his supporters in the GOP will stop at nothing to rig election results.
Suderman, you're our norms guy. These anti-certification efforts, basically like all the other attempts since early November to challenge the election, are going to fail shambolically. Joe Biden's going to get sworn in. Like, that's going to happen. So why does Ted Cruz acting this way matter? What is, like, what's the worst case scenario that we're supposed to be scared at when, in fact, they're not going to succeed in whatever it is that they're doing?
Well, Trump, I would say that Trump has really succeeded in making an ass out of Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz, but I mean, they managed to do that a long time ago on their own. Yeah, I think in one way, you're right. These are almost certainly the, what we heard on the phone call from Trump to Brad Raffensperger. These are in some ways idle threats in the sense that they won't be followed up on. But I actually want to drill down on what Trump said in that clip and some of the other stuff he says on that call. It's more than bullying. It's more than just sort of pressing the issue. This is the president of the United States, the most powerful politician in the country, maybe in the world, the head of the Justice Department. And he is threatening a state official with a criminal charge. It's a vague threat, sure. Like I said, probably an idle one, but it is a threat of a criminal charge for refusing to rig the election results. This isn't a matter in which both sides have a point, in which there's sort of like, oh, there's an argument here and there's an argument there. Trump lost the election. He challenged the election in court. He lost 59 times, something like that. There were nearly 60 lawsuits, and Trump, I think, maybe won one of them on like some small procedural technical thing. And that was often in courts with Republican judges, even Trump-appointed judges. This tape is a recording of a sitting president threatening criminal charges for not participating in a scheme to overturn a Democratic election that no one, including Trump's lawyers, has offered a single shred of evidence is fundamentally wrong. That's a remarkable abuse of power, and we should be really worried when a bunch of Republican senators come out and support it and say, oh, I'm just asking questions. And I mean, look, part of the problem is this is done under the pretext. Hawley is saying, well, this is that this is because, you know, Trump's just asking questions about the election result in good faith. People have real questions here, real concerns. No. Nobody has any real concerns, nothing substantive at all. Trump is just trying to find a way to cheat. That's it.
What is the threat?
So
from Trump.
Yes.
He said over and over, this is going to go badly for you. This would be criminal if you were not reporting the votes.
I'm going to read you the quote. I have it right here. So I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have. That's a quote. You know what they did and you're not reporting it. You know, that's a criminal. That's a criminal offense. And you know, you can't let that happen. That's a big risk to you and to Ryan, your lawyer. That's a big risk. He is saying that that is a risk of criminal penalties that your lawyer should be concerned about. That's what Trump said to Raffensperger. That is a threat of a criminal charge from the head of the Justice Department, from the president of the United States. That's not just bullying. That is something much worse.
Yeah, to his credit, Raffensperger doesn't seem at all perturbed. I mean, I read the transcript. I didn't listen to the full audio. And one of the things that for me that came through is that it's not surprising that Trump would take it down to the wire. And somebody somewhere talked about how this was like Trump bullying suppliers, you know, in a business setting. And I think that that's
except when Walmart bullies their bread supplier, Walmart cannot threaten them with criminal
penalties.
You know
what, though, Peter? I mean, but the fact of the matter is that, like, does this, you know, fundamentally change anything that we know about Trump? Anything about the sanctity of elections in America? No, it doesn't. You know, and I think for me, there are a couple of things to take away from this. One is absolutely upbeat and positive. The other one is more of a mix. And the first is that at no point did Raffensperger or anybody in Georgia be like, oh, my God, I got to cave in. I mean, the big lesson, I think, ultimately of the Trump years is that the system held, that the checks and balances and the dispersion of power and the overlapping spheres of influence worked. Every time when people say Trump will stop at nothing, He has stopped every time. He tries and then he retreats. And nobody seriously, I will take this all back if he actually refuses to leave the White House, come Inauguration Day and things like that. I'm not saying that's a good thing, but I think the real takeaway is that you have somebody like Trump who is testing and poking at every possible weak spot. And every time there's any semblance of pushback, he completely caves and goes away.
This isn't just a semblance
or in the case
of
pushback, of things,
though. This is wildly out of the ordinary.
No, it is. What? Yeah. So, yeah. And the point is that the system held, do we have any reason to believe that Joe Biden is not going to be sworn in as president and take over? I'm not saying this is a glorious thing, but I think it's. Also, it's important not to be like, oh my God, Trump is a fascist. He's such a fascist that every time every bold, dinky, a politician or an official at every level that pushed back on him,
Nick, I don't believe that you would take the same kind of this isn't that big a deal position if it were a state attorney general making a similar sort of threat to someone in service of, say, trying to overturn the election result of a state governor. And when people who have the power of the law backing them make these sorts of threats, it's a big deal, even if they don't intend to follow through on them.
I don't disagree with that. I'm saying that the point is that when you look at the way that people have pushed back and where are we now, I think we're in pretty good shape. The system held, and that's not a small thing to keep in mind. The thing that I wanted to say that I think is much starker, and I think what was much more interesting to me in reading it, is that you saw in Trump, and actually Eric Weinstein of all people had a phenomenal thread on Twitter about this, that Trump was right to note, Trump is right to feel beleaguered. There is no question that the media and everybody who could, in whatever passes for an establishment, had it in for him from the beginning. Can I finish?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. But this is okay. Actually, I found Weinstein's thread very frustrating.
I didn't. But why don't you tell me what you found frustrating about it then, Peter?
What Weinstein basically says is that this was a media conspiracy against him that he was right about. No, this wasn't
no,
4 years
of media
bashing
that caused
this.
That's not at all what Weinstein said. He said that Trump was right to believe that the media was arrayed against him in every possible way, and that when he came to try and contest the election results, he had nothing. All he had was a gut feeling that is absolutely divorced from reality, which is, I think, is true. What's interesting to me about the transcript or reading the call, listening to the call, reading the transcript, is that what you see in Trump is somebody who says, I couldn't have lost because I'm fucking Donald Trump and I always win. I'm a winner. And then he goes out looking for reasons or the logic for why he couldn't win. And he has to come up with conspiracy theories and bullshit claims, which are absolutely bullshit. What we have now in the United States, and I have friends like this, I suspect that many of us do, who absolutely believe that the election was stolen and that, ballots were shredded here and that, busloads of votes were brought in illegally or taken away illegally, et cetera. How do we deal with this? Because Trump, again, is not ultimate. He's not the cause of all of this. He is the effect of a shift away from a common belief in authority and trust and valid reality.
He is.
None of this
is
going away.
A major part of the cause of that belief.
Yeah,
he's not the.
It's a feedback. It's a feedback loop.
But the line about he's just he's the. He's the end result of a long process. While true in many respects, in this particular respect, it's him. He's the one. I mean, Republicans are right now saying, "Hey, I'm just out there trying to validate the feelings of frustrations that Republicans have that they've lost faith in the election." Well, who's been whipping that up? I mean,
What do we say? What do we say? But I mean, like, if you take it, what I'm interested in is something that is far bigger than politics, because what we've had, and I think I've talked about this before, what we've seen over the past 20 years, 30 years, maybe it's 50 years, who knows? But an absolute triumph of a kind of postmodern sensibility where there are competing realities, there are competing truth claims in all aspects. You know, go look at environmentalist Twitter, go look at Black Twitter, go look at, you know, any Twitter you want, libertarian Twitter, and you will find people who are living in radically different realities that are immune from any kind of correction from without. And that's what we're living
to
at.
To answer your question, Nick, like what do you do with, you know, those people who stubbornly hold on to these beliefs? I think the first thing that you do is that you say, you're wrong.
You're wrong.
And it doesn't matter how much you hate the media. It doesn't matter how much you've lost trust in institutions. You have a responsibility as a person in the world not to believe and spread the belief of dumb, crazy crap. Patrick Byrne has a responsibility to not act like an absolute ass clown every day of the week, which is what he's doing
now. Is the world going Patrick Byrne's way or not? I mean, that's also part of the correction mechanism, which is that Patrick Byrne,
but
who was, you know, the
ideas,
founder and
right?
head of,
I mean,
of
is,
Overstock, is not anymore and will be heard from less and less. People like
these are two separate ideas. I mean, you can simultaneously say, luckily, our institutions held. Luckily, the truth is generally winning out. Luckily, people who are being calm and level-headed are going to prevail. Those are all good things. You can also say it is wrong to do things like what we heard Donald Trump do on that tape. Like very, very wrong. Specifically, morally wrong for him to do as an individual. He is not a cause or an effect.
Yep.
He is not beleaguered by the media or a folk hero. Like, those things may or may not be true, but we can just say specifically, I'm actually a little surprised to find you here at the beginning of 2021 holding the line on this. Like, in the end, Trump ain't that bad. I do think the Gene Healy line, which appears in the current issue of the magazine, which is to say Trump wasn't in the end a dictator, he played one on TV, is correct. But you're not excused from condemnation for your bad behavior just because it didn't work. And I think this is just so clear cut that the people who are still backing him at this point, when he is on tape very specifically saying, we need to find some votes so I can win just because I believe in my heart that I won. Like, this is a good moment for those of us who dig the rule of law to be like, okay, but really, not this. Don't do this.
I'm not questioning that. What I'm saying is that if you think are the conversations going forward in politics or beyond now are going to change because Trump is gone, you're wrong, because this is part and parcel of a different reality that I don't think we fully have come to grips with. And it affects every part of our, every part of our governance.
That's a different claim than the one you made at the beginning of this conversation, though. I think that thing that you just said is true.
I said there were two points. There were two points that I was making. There were two points, one good and one not so good, because I think this latter point, and I say this as somebody who, you know, identifies as postmodern and understanding the way that people construct reality and whatnot, it's a real challenge.
What's your postmodern pronoun?
To things going
Nick,
forward.
Just so that we know going forward. Doctor?
Doctor.
Yeah.
I don't use pronouns anymore, Matt. I find them offensive.
You don't use the letter E anymore?
I just want verbs.
Suderman, I would normally in this point invite you to actually answer my question, since I think it would help, but I think you're not geared towards that at the moment, of the norm, right? What happens? What's the next thing that happens? I think there's a future, like there's a boomerang pendulum swing effect.
Gosh,
where there's learned behavior on both sides when someone sees this happen. But I'm going to get into a different question, which is Catherine invoked Gene Healy. Gene Healy was a big proponent of using the impeachment power more promiscuously. I might add parenthetically here that California is thinking about getting back on its I'm blanking on the name of the term of art, but of firing Gavin Newsom because they have that power in their constitution like they did with Gray Davis. What's the word?
Recalling.
Thank you. But anyways, there are some people out there on in the media world saying, sure, there's only, I don't know how many days left, 17 days left of this debacle, we should impeach him again, or at least censure him. We should lay down a legal marker saying that you can't do that. Is that something that you would favor, Peter Suderman?
17 days to impeach a president who has already lost seems like the sort of thing that you write into your screenplay when you haven't figured out an ending for your screenplay. And while I'm a firm believer in the life emulates screenplay theory of political narratives, I'm not sure that you should intentionally engineer that kind of half-assed ending. Your question about norms was the one I was sort of trying to answer earlier, and perhaps I didn't get there. I think the problem is here is that Trump is doing something that isn't a policy outcome, but it is a process outcome. He is making an almost certain to fail attempt to overturn a legitimate election. And what that does is not affect the size of government directly. It doesn't. It's not an order that says, oh, we're going to have more regulations or fewer regulations or higher taxes or lower taxes. It's not an appointment of a judge, but it affects the political process, the institutions that govern all of our lives and the underlying political values that people adhere to or say they adhere to and then don't. And without those values in place, without those institutions being somewhat functional, we don't have a system that will allow for the kinds of freedoms and liberties that we all take for granted. We don't have a system that will create outcomes that people who disagree can basically say, oh, well, I think this is fair and I'm going to accept this. And so what Trump has done here repeatedly for 4 years, but especially over the past couple of months since the election, is he has degraded those institutions. He's degraded the political system and the political values that we have that make American freedom possible. And the result here isn't going to be seen in some very clear thing where, oh, man, the FICA tax went up. The EPA is now not regulating some emission that they used to. It's not going to be like that. But what's going to happen is that the system itself is going to be more fragile, and people are going to be more likely to defect from it and act in ways that are contrary to the values that make, like I said, the sort of liberties that all of us enjoy and take for granted possible.
So
how
do you
into a short sentence and into a question? Hold on, Nick. I'll allow you to do this. So the Suderman argument, Nick, is that basically he's degrading the institutions that you were saying held. And so that's the problem. So how do you address that?
No, I don't disagree with what Peter is saying. And I want to reiterate that this is a process that started long before Trump and will continue after him. Because when you have people like Mitt Romney, you know, writing off 47% of the electorate, they're not going to vote for me anyway, so I need to go where the votes are. Hillary Clinton talking about a basket of deplorables. The era of the modern era of no decision, where the Republicans and Democrats flip from control back and forth because they make no attempt to get more, to actually get a sustainable working majority. Rather, they are trying to get the barest majority so that they can ram through their stupid program so that they get voted out of office at the next earliest opportunity. This is the problem. The way you fix it ultimately is by having people who are now in the majority. It's up to people like Joe Biden. It's up to people like Nancy Pelosi to start creating a sustainable majority, or Mitch McConnell, which means we're up Schitt's Creek because none of these people are interested in that kind of thing. I think norms matter in the way that Peter is talking about, not in terms of what the end goals are, but do you believe in the system, that the system is meaningful and that the system is actually honest and truthful in some way? That's got to come from people in the center. It's not going to come from Ted Cruz. It's not going to come from Josh Hawley. It's got to come from people who have got literally and figuratively gone missing in Congress. It's Justin Amash. It is people like Jeff Flake. There's a couple of other Democrats. It could be somebody like Joe Manchin if he wasn't kind of devoid of any kind of higher level functioning so that he could talk about these things, where you are not the enemy if you occasionally vote with somebody else from a different party.
Catherine, one thing that I've seen a takeaway that people have responded to the last 4 years, I'm thinking of Corey Whalen, who used to work for Justin Amash and others, is that, hey, character actually matters more than I thought. Character and the character and like ideology test, we overweighted ideology in the past. We should have been looking at character. There's, you know, a bunch of people who seem like their ideology made them good, and now I'm seeing the way that they behave is bad. Is that a takeaway to be had of the last 4, 5, 10, 12, 30 years? Do you feel like character is something that we should be looking at more regardless of where someone's ideology is?
I'm pretty wary of going down that road, even though I understand why some have at this point. And it's, you know, partially my kind of vague amateur hour public choice background, which leads me to think, hey, you know, you need to be careful about saying that, you know, the either the problem is the bad people in the system or the solution is getting good people in the system. When instead you need to look at the incentives that govern the system, and that sort of matters above all. I think that sometimes character and ideology are substitutes for each other. That is to say, a very, very ideological person, it doesn't maybe matter so much what his character or temperament is. If you know what he's going to do because he is deeply ideological, then you can vote him in or out based on that. You don't need to know his character. For people who are less ideological and more pragmatic, like, say, Joe Biden, then maybe you need to weight their character more because that's going to be more determinative about what they do. I think, you know, I remain convinced that a highly compatible ideologue is preferable in office to a good man. But I see why people might have gone squishy on that point in recent years, and I am sympathetic to it.
I think it's a false opposition because somebody like Ted Cruz, because with Trump, you know, there was no ideology and there was no character. Somebody like Ted Cruz,
right. Trump was neither, which is why people are confused right now.
But somebody like Ted Cruz, I first met Ted Cruz at a Club for Growth meeting when he was still running for the nomination to become a senator, to run for the Republican nomination for Senate. Back
before he had a beard.
It was a long time before he was doing a Wolverine 2024 or 2048 cosplay. But he couldn't go more than 2 seconds talking to Club for Growth, which only cared about economic issues and kind of regulatory issues, without bringing up how a Sharia law was being enacted in Oklahoma. And people were just like, what the fuck are you talking about? Ted Cruz has always been bad character and bad ideology. I mean, he, you know, from a libertarian point of view, there's a couple of points of contact on stuff, but he's never been a libertarian. He could never be confused for a libertarian. So I think most of the time when you see people who, you know, ultimately character and ideology, and I'm not saying you have to agree with me in order to have good character, you know, ideologically, but it's, you know, this is a false choice. Most people are pretty bad or good, period.
But that said, Nick, I mean, should someone with a blazingly bad character, which I think Donald Trump has his whole life blazingly bad character, should that just be a no-fly zone? As someone to support.
What does that mean? He was running against Hillary Clinton, the one person, I think history shows us, the one person that he could actually beat in a presidential race. And he did, because her character is bad.
To answer your question, what that means is if someone's character rises above two or above a level, there's just like no consideration of that person in higher office, either as an individual.
I think the trouble is we're not good judges of character among our nearest and dearest, never mind from afar. Like, I think that, you know, on some level, the flaw in that plan is twofold. One, it's hard to know people's hearts. It's hard to know whether they, in fact, are, you know, of robust moral character or whatever you want to say. But the other is, you know, the little bit of like loopy recursiveness in Nick's last answer about whether, like, basically the possibility of a person having excellent character, being a genuinely upright human being, and say a socialist. I think that that is very possible. Very possible. I think that you could be a good dude and a socialist. And I, so that, like, there are limits to the character test there. And that's why I fall back on the ideology test. I would, I just think, you know, again, they're not one-to-one, but they are to some extent substitutes if what you are, if you have a vision of a more just world that involves policymaking. And I do.
I mean, the thing about Trump is that his character has been pretty obvious from the beginning, right?
And if I may,
sure, dude. I mean, he sucks, right? But I think as a general rule, this is not an actionable rule.
No, he was so nice. He was so nice.
We're gonna go ahead.
I think one of the takeaways from this, though, is to go back into a discussion of libertarian nihilism from a libertarian point of view, because I don't really care what other people think about stuff for the purposes of this podcast. If libertarians are committed to the idea that all people, all politicians or all policy or all government actions are bad, evil, incompetent, should be gotten rid of, et cetera, we are willing to put up with people who are manifestly bad actors, either from a character perspective or ideologically, if they're simpatico with us or if not. And I think we need to, you know, one of the things from a specifically libertarian point of view is that we need to expect and demand better from our elected officials and from our policy people, because there are better and worse policies, there are better and worse politicians, and we should do well to cultivate the best in both of those kind of areas.
I think that one of the worst kind of political intellectual tendencies will be recorded historically as the Flight 93 essay in 2016. It's Flight 93s all the way down on the left and on the right. And once you get into that level of catastrophizing, then it doesn't matter. Nothing matters. We need to avoid the bad thing. We'll fly anything. We're going to talk about Justin Amash, who was referenced earlier, in a bit, since he has just left the building after a five-term run in Congress. But first, we're going to go to our email question of the week. This is one of many new exciting features of the Reason Roundtable. It's going to be rolled out in 2021. Here's how it works. Send us an email. We'll read it. Not all of them. The best one of the week, or at least the one that is chosen. You send those emails to roundtable@reason.com. Tell us your name or whatever you want us to call you, your postmodern pronouns, Twitter account, whatever. Our inaugural question asker is our pal, Roger Barris, who asked this. And I'll direct it first at Nick to give us a historical thing, and then at Catherine. Have you folks ever thought about naming a person of the year to compete with the insipid Time version? The obvious winners for 2020 would be the people involved in the vaccines, Pfizer and Moderna, including the CEOs who took enormous risks and mobilized huge resources, or Jeff Bezos, who kept us fed, supplied, and entertained, and even some rockets for KMW. Nick, just the historical thing. We've done the 35 heroes of Reason on the 35th anniversary, and the 45th anniversary under Catherine was the enemies of freedom. I think it was Catherine, right? Or was it me?
I think it was you.
Whatever.
I was napping. Nice shifting.
Our ego merge is complete.
Catherine
now
was doing a lot in those last couple of years. So, have we done or thought about
Catherine Mangu Ward as person
but like
of the year?
Though. Person of the year from like 2013. Just to be clear.
Yeah, for having edited this magazine for the past 45 years out of 50. No, I don't believe that we ever had any serious kind of discussion of that. I've never liked the man of the year, the woman of the year, the party of the year, etc. I'm not a big fan of year-end lists in general, but institutionally, I don't believe that was ever much of a concern.
Catherine, so do you have plans for this, or do you just want to cheer for some rockets?
I always want to cheer for some rockets. Now, my piece from the last issue in praise of COVID billionaires, I think just went live online, and I stand by it. I think, the convention of assigning someone a person of the year has gone so badly for Time so many times in the recent past. It's basically a joke at this point. So I would not want us to get in the business of doing it annually. And to be honest, the people who Roger mentioned, people like Bezos and Musk, who have really had bang up years, they don't need us to award them the title Person of the Year. I saw a piece, I think this morning, saying that between them, they had earned like $750 billion this year or something. I may be getting the number wrong and I don't have it right in front of me, but it was like—
They earned a stimulus package.
It was an unthinkably large amount of money. So like they don't need a Reason magazine cover. You know, like they're good. They won already this year. But I do think, you know, I do think that the Time choice of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris was deeply ridiculous. There were some genuinely impressive human feats this year, like truly world historically impressive, especially the making of the vaccine, but also just the individual sacrifices of healthcare workers and others. You know, the people who brought us all our stuff to our houses every day while we were scared to go outside, like. Those people, for crying out loud, those people, like, I am not a woman of the people. I am an elitist in my deep, deep soul. But if we are choosing a person of the year this year, it's not Joe Biden. It's Amazon delivery dudes.
Thanks, Roger. Again, email that stuff to roundtable@reason.com. Ask one all questions, etc. All right. After five full terms in the House of Representatives, Justin Amash, who is the only ever Congress critter to wear the L on his jersey, which he did for most of 2020 as a member of the Libertarian Party after having gone independent for about a year and he was a Republican before that. Anyways, this is it. This is last week. He's done. He's peaced out. Reason's been writing about him forever. Most of us, maybe all of us, have interviewed him on multiple occasions. And the first thing that we wrote about was a Brian Doherty feature in search of the next Ron Paul's out there, and Amash was seen even way back then as kind of the leading candidate of all of that. So I think this occasion calls for a bit of reflection amongst us. Peter, I want to start with you since you haven't talked in a while, but also because Amash, God bless him, is just about the most like wonky institutionalist critic of Congress for a long time, pointing out how the system doesn't work. Can you speak to that level of his contribution or his analysis as he departs?
Yeah. So Justin Amash does a bunch of stuff that's great just on a strict policy level, right? He goes out in like a flaming ball of end civil asset forfeiture and no more national emergencies, right? Like, and it's totally great. He's right on policy very frequently, probably more frequently than any other nationally elected official of the last 4 years. But he also really understands the value of good systems and good processes and good rules that people agree to adhere by. And so one of the things that he has done is criticize Republican leadership, which has been really quite bad over the last decade or two, criticize it for amassing power at the expense of ordinary legislators. And so bills get written in the leader's office. They get written by a very small number of people, and then they get released, you know, like we saw just in the last week or so with the latest relief bill. They get released and it's 5,000 pages, and you're just expected as a congressman like Justin Amash to vote for it. You don't get a chance to read it. You don't really get a chance to comment on it. If you do, it's you're just going to have to like control F the thing, you know, in a couple of hours and put out some tweets. And it's a completely ridiculous way of doing business. And Amash has been one of the central and most intelligent critics of that tendency. And I think he's right that it's not just about the policy outcomes. It's about the processes by which you achieve those policy outcomes and also the processes themselves, setting them up in a way that is fair, that is transparent, that have good incentives. Those processes give us either better or worse policy outcomes. And you have to actually fix the processes in some ways before you fix the policy outcomes, because without good processes in place, you're quite likely to have bad policy outcomes in the future. And like, and in some ways, the processes are arguably more important. And this is a thing, you know, that I sort of, he constantly sort of reiterates, this is what the founders were concerned with. Is yes, there were some things where they just said, look, here are individual liberties that you have. Here are very specific rights that everyone has. That's very important. Those are, I think, in some ways, policy outcomes, but they're also kind of process outcomes. But what the Constitution was a process document. It was a way of doing business for the government, right? It was a way of managing and thinking about governance that was designed not just to give you good outcomes in the first Congress or the second or the first 10 years of the United States. It was a way of thinking about how to do governance over a very long period of time that assumed that you wouldn't necessarily have people of good ideology or good character, and was built, hopefully, to withstand a lot of that.
Catherine, what are you going to miss or about Amash, and or what is your takeaway about the import of his five terms?
I'm really feeling the Nancy Pelosi gets re-upped, like 80-year-old, no, you know, nothing is ever going to change. All of Congress is the same forever, and it shall henceforth never do anything, versus Amash, like literally the one congressman I've ever identified with or liked basically in any way, just like fading out. And the fact that he tweeted, I leave you now, and you will write it, you will interpret it, that's your right, but as I leave you, I want you to know, blah, 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 blah. You won't have Amash to kick around anymore, because Congress, this is my last tweet. And then 3 hours later, he had to tweet, guys, it was a parody. Like, that's such a fitting end. Like, he was too smart and too weird for Congress. R.I.P. Justin Amash.
Nick, I know you wanted to, you encouraged him to run for president, which he flirted with for a hot week or so in 2020 after, you know, thinking about it for God knows how long. I ultimately chose not to do that. What do you wish for Mr. Amash's future?
I wanted to call attention to what I think is the actual first mention of him at Reason.com, which was by Catherine in 2010 on May 28th when he was still a state legislator.
Wow.
I don't even know what this is going to be.
The headline pretty much says it all. Legislator posts votes on Facebook, all of them. She screenshotted some stuff from Facebook where Amash, who was then a legislator in Michigan, he was running for Congress but hadn't been elected yet because this was May of 2010, explained one of his votes, and then he had a press release talking about how he was, as far as anybody knew or as far as his people knew, the first legislator anywhere to post all of his votes, explanations for all of his votes on Facebook. A thing that he continued doing throughout his time in Congress. And to me, that is the model. That is, he didn't stray far from that. And if everybody just did that, I think so many good things would fall from that. And as Catherine wrote, the fact that this idea is novel shows how far we are from a real voluntary culture of disclosure in our legislatures. And so I think, for me, that's kind of how I want to remember Amash, as a John the Baptist of something that hopefully will become, reality, where politicians aren't just held accountable, but actually put their accounts out there for people to sift through. I think that's a great thing. And I hope that Amash, I don't know that it'll be in politics, but I hope that he continues to be a major player in American culture in the 21st century. He's an interesting, one of the reasons I thought he would be great to run for president is that he, he's in his early 40s, so he's right around, millennial age, but he looks like America of the future.
He is exactly 40, yeah. And he is almost exactly between Catherine
both
and me.
Both dispositionally and chronologically, I would say.
And so,
can I just say,
but
like...
he, you know, he's, he, Yes.
No, it's just I love it that I'm like this is the first thing I've ever been a hipster on. Like, I liked Dimash before he was cool. Like, oh, you probably haven't heard of him. He's just like a state legislator, but you know, like, I think he's going to be kind of big. Like, this is it. This was my moment, guys.
This is the go ahead.
I think he one of the things that I liked about him, and again, this is from a libertarian point of view. More than, certainly, I don't care about Republicans or Democrats, but he looks like the America of the present and increasingly of the future. He is multi-ethnic. He is his parents were immigrants, refugees. In fact, he had a very different view of how the future should go, and he is kind of, in many ways, is kind of like the anti-AOC. In that he's very individualist, he's very capitalist, he's very free and open source rather than the idea of regulating and controlling every aspect or of using identity simply as a way to shut people down as opposed to kind of discuss and connect with more and more people. I think, I don't want to put too much on a single person personifying where we could be going or where we should be going, but I think, you know, his life as well as his actions and his identity, such as it exists, is, you know, he's somebody who we should see more of rather than fewer of in American public life.
I like the headline to Nick's interview with him from May. Justin Amash: people want a president who is normal, honest, practical, and capable. Right? That's it. Like,
I think we'd settle for one of those.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, two out of...
One thing I'll add is that his critique of Congress, which Peter talked about at fine length, is, and you know, which he's tweeted about in his you know, dying breaths. Like, we're talking about him like he's dead. It's pretty funny.
I know, it really is like a little bit of a eulogy situation here. He's probably going to do something. I mean, to be honest, what he's probably going to do is be back in office at some point. Like, I know that he set a few bridges aflame and that will be challenging, but this is my prediction. He'll be back in some form of elected
when you
office.
Spend most of your adult life running and campaigning and winning elections, including ones that people said you wouldn't. You know, that becomes part of the old
he's going to chase the dragon
skill set. No, but like his final day in office, is he's tweeting the number of floor amendments that had been offered year by year, and like with numerical specificity that I totally appreciated. Of course, the last several years it's the number is zero, but like in 2013 it was, I don't know, 413 or something. But his overall take on Congress, as Peter was mentioning, leads me to a disquieting place. I mean, it really is that Congress is not a deliberative body, and it has forfeited so much power and policymaking, not just to, you know, the handful of people in leadership for their annual crapnibus bill at the end of the year, but specifically to the executive branch. And that's bad. And that has led to a lot of the dysfunction that we have, including just the normal dysfunction of the way that most people talk about or consume and certainly journalistically write about politics, which is everything has to be about what the president or, you know, future president wants to do, regardless of whether the issue at hand has nothing to do with the federal government or shouldn't have anything to do with the federal government. All of that's really bad dysfunction. And the trend lines on all of it are rotten. And it leads me to a pessimistic place, which I don't like. The other thing I'll add is that his replacement, Peter Meyer, I think you pronounce his name, of the Meyer supermarket chain, which is great, might be an interesting dude. Just gonna throw that out there. Follow him, CD3. Already a good Twitter follow, and seems like a potentially decent dude. So that's all I have to say about that. Let's go to our end of podcast. What have you been consuming? I'll start. What the heck? Not that I'm going to be taking anything that anyone watched. So I'm always fascinated by like animated movies that fell through the cracks for some reason, that were big at the time and maybe still great reviewed, but like just didn't become canon in a certain way. Partly I'm interested in that just because, you know, family movie night has to run out all of its possible courses. And so we watched The Prince of Egypt, Did that stain your childhood or something, Catherine? Or this is an animated DreamWorks picture from 1998, basically telling the story of Moses. The crossing the Red Sea is the big denouement of this one. So it's not
spoilers.
Val Kilmer plays both Moses and God.
Val Kilmer's last good movie.
There's some kind of confusion there.
The realism, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, you're not wrong about that. It's very pretty to look at. None of the songs are memorable. And it's rough to watch with a 5-year-old. There's a lot of, you know, my exposure to religion over the last few years have been through the Catholic Church. And, you know, they read the bit from the Old Testament, then they read the bits in the New Testament, and they try to tie it all together, get a nice rug to tie it all together. And, usually the stuff they read in the Old Testament isn't specifically about God killing a lot of firstborn babies. It's like, wow, I'd forgotten the Old Testament, man. That's a rough one.
I mean, this is Passover, my man. Like, every single year, it's like, let's all get together and have matzo balls and talk about the death of firstborns. Like, it's the realness.
I mean, that was an interesting period for American animation. There's a great piece in one of the new New Yorkers by Adam Gopnik, a review of the new book.
A great piece by Adam Gopnik?
Yeah, but it's a review of a book, Wild Minds, the artist's.
Yeah, so, Peter, what timeline? What alternate timeline are you visiting?
From this timeline, yes, we perhaps live in alternate realities, Nick, but in this timeline that I live in, Adam Gopnik wrote a great piece about a new book on the history of American animation that is that sort of traces it as a cultural force and kind of seeks to both tell the story of some of the rivalries that defined it early, but then also sort of the evolution over time, and to kind of define animation and just like cartoons and cartooning as a major cultural force in a way that I think some of us sort of think of it as, oh, this is just sort of throwaway stuff. But in fact, it's kind of amazing that so much of the media we consume now started, if you think, you know, even superhero movies, et cetera, started just like a guy at a desk, you know, with a pen and a piece of paper drawing a little cartoon of like a guy with some big muscles or a mouse that with a funny voice, you know.
Only eat Popeye brand spinach.
Suderman, why don't you tell us? Go ahead, Nick. You and
I just wanted to point out that DreamWorks SKG, this was their first big animated movie, and it was so seen as an attack on Islam that the movie was banned in a bunch. This was part of the story when it came out. I saw it in Delaware, Ohio, in the theater, but it was banned in several Muslim majority countries.
Was it banned in Oklahoma, where Ted Cruz was warning that?
But
Sharia
it also
law?
Won. No. You know, it was. You could only watch it. Was The Man in the High Castle was releasing parts of it. In Ted Cruz's Oklahoma, but it won an Academy Award for Best Song, Matt, because it was the music was written by Stephen Schwartz, who had, you know, a ton of a basket full of Oscars from various kinds of musicals and Disney productions.
The music's no good. Peter, although the score is by Hans Zimmer.
Like, if you have to just pick a random composer who probably did a score over the last 30 years, you should pick Hans Zimmer.
Just one of those things you can just like guess as a default.
Yeah. So I watched the movie Martin Eden, which is getting rave reviews. It's been at the top of a bunch of critics' lists. It is only streaming through a couple of like independent film center websites. So you can't like go on Amazon and rent this. You have to go to the Avalon Theater, buy a ticket, and then you can like watch it on your phone and stream it to your Apple TV or whatever. So it's this, it is a sort of transliteration of an old Jack London novel that is kind of about his own life. The novel was written in 1909. This has been moved to an Italian setting that is kind of timeless. It's sort of historical, but you also see like more modern, not quite today's level, but like modern televisions and cars, in part probably because of budget limitations. But this thing just looks absolutely incredible. And it is a movie that grabs grapples with libertarian ideas, and I think in a real and direct way, more than almost anything else I've seen this year, because it is about the idea of individualism. And so it takes place sort of against the backdrop of some of the sort of early 20th century, you know, wars and political revolutions in Italy, and you've got sort of arguments about unionism and about capitalism. And you've got this guy who wants to be a writer, and he is constantly saying that, look, you people who are capitalists, you're just doing the same thing the socialists are doing, except you're getting government favors to make yourself rich. And look, you union people, you're just asking for different masters, right? Like it's, you know, you're not actually saying you want to be free. And he gives there's like a speech about where is the individual in your politics. And then I think, ultimately, the movie is a critique of individualism. It is not a libertarian movie. It's not one that says, oh, libertarians are right, because in the end, Martin Eden kind of becomes a kind of evil individualist. He falls into a bad version of the ideology that the movie equates with a sort of fascism. And so, you know, it's not necessarily a movie where I think I agree with all the ideas, but it's really gorgeously rendered, incredibly well acted, and it actually engages with a bunch of these ideas in a way that is just really rare to see on screen and was pretty enjoyable.
Nick, I know you want to deliver a dissertation on Jack London's socialist individualism.
No, I just want to just point out that McTeague, the novel for which he's probably best.
All good.
Never mind. Excuse me. I'm thinking off kilter, so never mind. Jack London, big racist, though. Big racist.
Yeah, are you thinking of the Frank Norris novel, McTeague?
I was thinking of Frank Norris, who is also from the Bay Area, Oakland in particular. But what's interesting about the early socialists in America is that they were all hyper-individualists, and they believed that socialism was the best way to foment, you know, broad mass individualism. Which is kind of interesting to think about. But Google Jack London at reason.com and you'll find some interesting stuff about the confluence of early environmentalism and racism.
And I would also add Google in the world, Jack London and Eastern Europe. He was, as someone who was a socialist, he was championed by anti-communists as an entire subcultures that were built around that. Who would go like tramping in the woods and things like that. It's a fascinating whole system of subcultures that are based on him. But go on, Nick.
Yeah. So I watched the third season of Search Party, which is a show that had originally been on, I think, TBS, but is now on HBO Max. The new season four, is starting in January 14th, so it gives people an opportunity to catch up. Search Party is a hilarious dark comedy. The best known actor in it is Aaliyah Shawkat, who's from Arrested Development and other things. But it's about a group of kind of like millennials, young 20-somethings, really, who kill a couple of people and then cover up the crime. It is freaking hilarious. It is a great show that mocks all sorts of kind of film genres and templates. And then the latest season three, which is a court drama, also layers that in a fantastic auto critique of generational contempt of millennials and boomers or Gen X people. If you want a show that is both funny and then a meta commentary on everything you hold near and dear to your life, watch Search Party. Fantastic. And the new season comes out in like 10 days.
Awesome. Catherine, take us out.
I sort of want to talk about Bean Dad as the internet's main character of this weekend, but maybe we shouldn't.
I think you should, especially since Bean Dad and Milkshake Duck are now joined at the hip. Right.
Yeah, Bean Dad. But can you be Jesse Walker raised this interesting question. Can you be Milkshake Ducked if you became the internet's main character for something bad already? So for those who don't know, congratulations. And also, let me just fill you in. Bean Dad. I can't even say this sentence. He tweeted about how his 9-year-old daughter was hungry and he told her to open a can of beans. and she didn't know how to use a can opener. And he basically made her figure out how to use a can opener on her own over the course of 6 hours, at which point she opened the can and they ate the beans. That's the condensed version. It was a funny Twitter thread. It sparked a conversation about whether this was basically the same as beating your children or what all parents should be like. And then subsequently, people started spelunking in Bean Dad's old tweets, and he got milkshake ducked because he has a lot of old tweets that are impolitic, to say the least. So I just want to go on the record saying, old tweets aside, Bean Dad's can opener parenting is the kind of parenting that I wish I did. But in fact, what I would have done is been like, let me just show you real quick. Here's how the can opener works. And then we would have been done.
Why isn't that the accurate response? I mean, like, I think Bean Dad is like a terrible teacher. That's what came through to
right.
me, is that he should show once, like, don't do it for your kid and, you know, and just give them everything. But like, say, hey, here's 15 minutes on how to work a can
15
opener.
Seconds. I don't think we need like a whole 15 minutes.
6 hour long. You know,
but you know what? You know, it was a teacher. I get it that sometimes as a parent, you back yourself into a corner.
A teachable moment.
You back yourself into a corner and then you're like, well, I have to see this one through and there's not going to be lasting harm. It might actually be good. I get that. But no, what I actually read was The Line of Beauty. I'm rereading it. It's a novel by Alan Hollinghurst. It won the 2004 Booker Prize. I probably read it about 10 years ago. It made a big impression on me. I'm rereading it now for a book club that I'm in. And the thing that I wanted to talk about, it's a book about, it's set in the 80s. It has a gay protagonist. There's the kind of, you might expect, kind of coming out story. There's an AIDS line. Margaret Thatcher makes a cameo. It's very much kind of a political novel in its moment about this kind of subculture. When I read it 10 years ago, it felt like a recognizable world. To me, it felt like, you know, the characters in this book were living in, you know, a situation that had gotten significantly better, but was still comparable to our own in terms of, you know, lots of people not comfortable coming out, living, you know, scared of AIDS, scared of how to live their lives inside a political context that was not friendly to their sexuality. And rereading it now, it is striking how it seems like another universe. Like the 10 years that have elapsed between the first and second read of this book have been so incredibly amazing. And it's like it's a frog boil thing. Like it's easy to forget how much better things have gotten. And like, obviously, there are still people who struggle with coming out. Obviously, there are still people who have HIV and AIDS and are suffering from that. These are still real issues, but the incredible, incredible different experience of reading this in 2010 and 2020. Obviously, I cannot recommend to our listeners that they time travel back to 2010 and read this book and then read it again. But if I could, I would, because it's really making me appreciate.
You can also experience that phenomenon. I suppose you have to be a certain age to have remembered what like 1990 was like. But I watched for the first time over the holidays Home Alone. There's not a single scenario in that movie that would even be possible in 2020. Like just none of it would have happened. Not just technologically,
just like, parenting, you know, wise, like peer relations wise,
you have to, like,
financially.
The joy of that movie was that it was outdated.
Sure. But like it's the tech especially is just like aggressively impossible to imagine.
I just appreciated Home Alone as an extended reference to Sam Peckinpah's Straw Dogs.
Mm. As one doesn't.
You know, it's more psychosexual, though, don't you think, Peter?
I just want to say about Bean Dad, if we're gonna go Bean Dad, dude was doing this so that he could like
finish a jigsaw puzzle.
Finish a jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah.
We're talking about a jigsaw puzzle.
That makes it better.
A jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah. But he wasn't doing it to finish the jigsaw. He was doing it.
I know.
Based
on his tweets, jigsaw puzzle is some kind of shout out to the Boogaloo Boys or something.
I think it's to it's a beggar's banquet
reference.
That's all of the really bad old fogey references that we're going to allow ourselves to have time for on this here Reason Roundtable podcast. Keep sending us emails, roundtable@reason.com. Keep listening to our various podcast offerings at reason.com podcasts. Reason.com/podcast. Yes, that's how it goes. And that includes the interview with Nick Gillespie, the big interview. He's no Dan Rather talking to old rock stars, but he is Nick Gillespie talking to very interesting people all the time and having great conversations. The Soho Forum podcast as well is worthy of your attention. And that's it. Goodbye. We'll see you next week.